Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 3rd of June. About every month, we search for a good history book so we can enter a classroom and learn history, and we've done that this month with a wonderful book about Henry Clay. Henry Clay, The Essential American is the name of the book, and our guests, David Heidler and Jean Heidler, residents of Colorado Springs, I love this story, met each other while they were studying at Auburn University. They both received their PhDs in U.S. history, and together as a husband and wife team, they have written numerous books and articles dealing with the history of the early American Republic, the antebellum period, and the Civil War, including Encyclopedia of the War of 1812 and the award-winning Encyclopedia of the American Civil War, a social, political, and military history. They are authors of Old Hickory's War, Andrew Jackson and the Quest for Empire, The War of 1812, Manifest Destiny, Daily Life in the Early American Republic, Creating a New Nation, 1790 to 1820, and the Mexican War. The Heidlers each maintain a regional teaching affiliation. David is with the History Department of Colorado State University in Pueblo, and Jean is professor of history at the United States Air Force Academy, where she is the senior civilian member of her department. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as we talk about Henry Clay, The Essential American, this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that as well. And that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And thank you both. I think I'll call you by your first names, or you won't know who I'm talking to when I say Professor Heidler, if that's okay. Thank you both so much for being with us. I love this image of you, that you met each other studying history, and then you're both historians, and you write books together. It's quite lovely.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, people marvel at the ability to conduct a congenial relationship in these kinds of projects, but it's worked out pretty well for us.
Well, you obviously share a great love of the material that you're working on, and there's so much to write about. I'm so glad you wrote about Henry Clay, because he's one of those people in history who was so darned influential, and I don't think we properly remember him these many years later.
That's true. He has... it's amazing that someone who was so influential and who had wielded such power and attracted such a huge following over the course of his career, which was from the turn of the 19th century all the way to almost to the eve of the Civil War, that he has receded into the shadows of American memory to the extent he has. And so we were hopeful that this will correct that.
Mm-hmm. His early life was so fascinating. I was struck by a couple of the stories that you tell, Jean. The quality that he had that serves anybody well in life, I think, is to be able to take jokes and give it back to people, to be able to have good humor about all of that.
Yes, he did. From his youth, as you read about, when he first went to Richmond and was working there as an apprentice, he was considered to be somewhat of a country bumpkin, and the city boys did make fun of him. And one of the ways that he got along with them, and in fact some of them became his closest lifelong friends, is that he took the ribbing very well, but he also gave it back in a good-natured way. And that is a characteristic that he has from his early teen years that we were able to discover, really up until his death. He always maintained a very good sense of humor.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the revolution coming to his doorstep when he was very young, David.
Well, he was 4 years old when the British mounted their serious campaign in Virginia, and that consisted of a mixture of a regular British army under Cornwallis and also irregular militia under Tarleton, Bannister Tarleton. And this invasion moved up the James River and finally came to the doorstep of the Clay Spring, the boyhood home. And as I say, he was 4 years old. His father had just died possibly only a week or so earlier. And the British ransacked the house. They came in and made a thorough mess of it, as well as stabbing the newly turned grave out in the outside in the yard with their swords to discover if any treasure had been hidden there, and then left. Clay remembered that to the day he died. He remembered the soldiers riding around, cutting up the feather bedding and tossing it out the windows and tearing through the house. He was gripping his mother's skirt, and his younger brother was on the other side of her. She apparently was quite brave during the entire episode, and he remembered that as well. His memory of that, though, would, I think, in some degree or other, color his perception of the British as a nation for years. He very, very reluctantly gave up that animus against the British for the way they had behaved that day.
Mm-hmm. And also colored his memory in a favorable way of his mother, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, his mother was a very important figure in his life until her death. She lived a very long time, until the late 1820s, and they remained very close, even though she did move to Kentucky with her second husband. That's one of the main reasons that he, too, moved to Kentucky once he had his law license. And they remained very close, and he admired her tremendously.
It must have been so difficult. Tell me about the decision to leave him behind in Virginia when they went to Kentucky and to not see him for a long period of time. Why would parents do that?
Well, partly because they needed to make sure that he could make his way in the world. They were not a rich, they were what we would probably describe as middle class. And for the male children especially, they had to learn a trade of some sort. And since his stepfather, who he was also very close to, who also happened to be a cousin, did want to make sure that he could make a good living and did have connections in Richmond, he was able to find him a place where he eventually was able to study law and make a very good career out of the law even before he went into politics.
It's always interesting, the people we run into in our lives who make us who we are in large measure. Can you tell the story of his getting an important job and making a very, very important contact on the basis of his handwriting?
Yeah, he was working in the chancery office, which was in the pecking order of the Virginia legal system, about as low as you got. That's where he met all of these youngsters from the city, and they showed him something of the ropes of Richmond, where he was, and the documents he was working on came to the attention of George Wythe, who was the Chancellor of Virginia. He was the head of the Court of Chancery, and had a distinguished career. Even by this point, he was Thomas Jefferson's mentor, and much for the same reason, because he had recognized in Jefferson's handwriting a meticulous attention to detail, high readability, and a grace to the handwriting. Jefferson and Clay are, in fact, the delight of historians because they decipher their hieroglyphics. Their handwriting is almost printing clear. And Clay's particular talent in this regard brought him to the attention of George Wythe, and he became his stenographer. He was the person who took all the documents that Wythe generated as the head judge of the state and turned them into legal briefs. The result was a relationship that grew between the old man and the youngster that was almost like father and son, as Wythe did treat proteges. And Wythe was able to introduce Clay not just to law, but also to a good many of the social graces of the period and the best social circles. So it was an incredibly important relationship that grew out of this job that he managed to get.
And books as well, Gene. What books did he give him?
Well, he gave him a lot of the classics, though Clay never developed a facility with languages, which is one of the things that Wythe and, of course, Jefferson had. And so he could only read the English classics, things that had been translated, and law books, Even though he did not study law directly under Wythe, Wythe did introduce him to some of the legal classics that probably whet his appetite for the law. And then, of course, Wythe was instrumental in placing him, as far as his law studies, with one of the most prominent attorneys in the state.
And tell me about Wythe's views on slavery. Of course, the issue of the day, an incredibly important issue for those who succeeded Clay as well. What were Wythe's stands on this? Because I know that Clay was mulling that about in his head for a long time.
Well, for one thing, Wythe was one of those founders, and he was certainly one of our founders, who saw the tremendous contradiction between the existence of slavery and the principles on which the revolution had been based. And so as a result, he did what a lot of other people talked about doing, but many, like Jefferson, for instance, never actually accomplished, and that is that he freed all of his slaves during his lifetime, rather than in his will, as some of the other founders did. And not only did he free them, but he provided for their education and training so that they could make their way in the world. Some of them stayed with him and worked for wages voluntarily, and others did actually practice trades that he had provided the money for. And this certainly influenced Clay. When he went to Kentucky, he was one of the most vocal proponents of gradual emancipation, in other words, providing for training and education and then emancipation. Though, as you have read, it is one of the more difficult parts of the book for us, because he, even though he was a lifelong proponent of emancipation, he will own slaves from virtually his birth until the day he died.
Like Thomas Jefferson. So what was going on with that, David?
Well, there were a couple of complex issues intertwined with slavery that for that generation became increasingly insoluble. Clay in the late 1790s in Kentucky made the very cogent argument that slavery was thin enough on the ground in Kentucky at that point to merit emancipation as a viable option, that in fact the longer and not too long, in fact, they let this lay as it was, it would become too deeply ingrained in all levels of the economy and the culture and would become increasingly, if not impossible, to eradicate. And so that, in a way, happens. Slavery becomes so integrated into the Southern economy as a labor as a source of labor, and also so integrated in the cultural fabric of the community, in terms of its social control of a large population of others, that is in some cases dwarfs the white population of areas. In the South Carolina Lowcountry, for instance, the ratio of black to white was 9-1, and that more firmly fixed slavery as an institution as much as the economic realities did. Clay found this the only way to avoid the only way out of this conundrum was a gradualism that would allow the country, not just the South, but the country, to absorb the economic losses that would result from the retirement of this considerable asset, but also adopt policies that would allow for slaves not to become casualties of freedom, that they would be able to make their way. And in fact, Clay finally came to the conclusion that there would be no way for the freed slaves to integrate into the prejudices of the white community, those prejudices born out of the slaves' former station. And that is the reason that he advocated colonization, mm-hmm. which the abolitionists found to be a despicable and contemptible policy, which has indeed, from the modern perspective, it is morally perverse. The notion that people cannot become citizens of the community because of their skin color and the prejudices of that community is something that is obviously not true. But it was, for all that, it was really the enlightened opinion of early 19th century America, and one held by, for instance, Abraham Lincoln as well, up until the time that he began to grow in his perceptions during the Civil War. So Clay's attitudes about this were pretty advanced and progressive, and they hurt him politically in the South, just as they hurt him in the North. He owned slaves, so he was unpopular in the North, and he condemned slavery, so he became unpopular in the South. Politically, it wasn't a terribly astute position, but at the same time, it was one born out of, I think, a sincere anxiety on his part of what slavery meant as a personal bane, and what it meant to the country as an insoluble problem that was likely to tear it apart, as indeed it did.
Were Lincoln's views on slavery, then, at least his early views, informed by Clay?
Certainly, yeah. Lincoln was a tremendous admirer of Clay from his early days in politics in the 1840s in Illinois. He followed Clay's career very closely and was on record during that time through the rest of his life as a tremendous admirer of Clay. And he had the personal connection through his wife, Mary Todd, who actually grew up not very far from Clay's home, Ashland, in Lexington, Kentucky, and their families were actually fairly close.
She brought her pony over, didn't she?
Yes, she did.
Yeah, that was a great little story. History is so fascinating, isn't it, in that regard? All these little things that happened, and I just, they're pretty gripping. I want to go back to when you were talking about the social life, because, you know, I was reading your book as the television was on, and, you know, I'm going to the computer later, and I'm thinking about how we entertain ourselves. And Clay and some of the others had this rip-roaring great times in the bar. They were gamblers.
Clay was a wild young man, I guess, is how we would describe him today. Even after his marriage, his socializing, particularly with the other lawyers, because he had to ride circuit to go to the different county seats to get their cases. And so as a result, they worked hard during the day but played hard at night. And, of course, Clay gained his nickname of Prince Hal after the young Prince Henry, who would become Henry IV, because of his wild youth. And so he was very colorful when he was a young man.
We welcome phone calls for our guests. We have much more to talk about. Obviously, we've been concentrating on his early life. He did run for president a number of times and is credited with saying, you'll remember this, but maybe you would be hard-pressed to remember who said it, "Sir, I'd rather be right than president." Henry Clay, the Essential American. David and Jean Heidler are our guests, the authors of this book. They have written many scholarly books and articles dealing with the history of the early American Republic, the antebellum period, and the Civil War. David with the Department of History at Colorado State University Pueblo, and Jean is professor of history at the United States Air Force Academy. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 800-486-8655. And our guests are the authors of Henry Clay, The Essential American. It has recently been published by Random House. And we have phone lines open. We also have this email thing that you can use. That is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. For you to join our conversation. And before we go to the phone calls and move more into his political life, do you think that he calculated his marriage, his courting of Lucretia, in order to advance himself in a material way, or did he love her?
Oh, yeah, I think it both. I think he obviously came to that house in Lexington, the Hart House, out of a sense of political astuteness, that he wanted entree into this high social circles, and this was the way to do it, marry well. He found himself an incredible young woman in that house. She was not a great beauty, never described as such by anyone who knew her, but those who did know her and came to know her, as we put it, those she took the trouble to know, found her absolutely lovely, and so did Clay. He did too. They grew to love each other very deeply. And the letters that he sends to her, she doesn't have any letters that survive. She wasn't much of a letter writer to start with, and most of the things that she wrote apparently have disappeared into oblivion. She and Clay were ideally suited to each other in their own ways.
Let's start with some calls. John is calling, driving toward Madison. Hi, John. Oh, I got to press the... Yeah, this should be John. Hi, John. Are you there? I don't know. No, I guess. It just sounded weird. I guess John isn't there. Our number is 800-486-8655. Let's move into politics. It's hard to think of Henry Clay and not think of Andrew Jackson. And you write about Andrew Jackson's shadow casting a pall over Clay's political life for more than a quarter century in some way or other.
Jackson was in many ways very different from Clay, and perhaps they were bound to clash one way or another. They certainly did believe different things, had a different philosophy of government, if you can say that Jackson actually developed a philosophy. But when they clashed over Jackson's invasion of Florida, Spanish Florida, in 1818, when Clay expressed his public disapproval of that obviously unconstitutional act that Jackson had committed, then he made a permanent enemy. Jackson was probably the best hater in American politics. Mm. And once Clay crossed him or even, again, criticized him, there was really no turning back. And from that point on, when Clay made that speech in 1819 in the House of Representatives, there was really no way that they would ever be able to come together after that.
And you say that he, in fact, lost almost every time he challenged Andrew Jackson. Why?
Jackson was a supremely popular, incredibly popular person, a political person. He was a force of nature in American politics. There had never been anything like him. And he, that sort of charisma and authority and power is almost impossible to challenge. Clay's efforts were quixotic. His one great success was remarkable nonetheless. He was able to secure the censure of Andrew Jackson by the United States Senate for executive overreach in terms of the bank, the fight over the United States Bank. That was a remarkable accomplishment, considering the fact that Jackson was so profoundly popular. Ultimately, though, he lost that as well, because the Senate expunged. They didn't repeal. They expunged it from the annals of the body. Clay thought that was the nadir. That was the low point of American political history when that happened, when the executive was able to get the legislature to mutilate its own records.
Oh, my.
And he found that development to be sufficiently troubling to contemplate permanent retirement from political life. In fact, withdrew for a time as a consequence of that disappointment.
Hmm. Let's go to Bill is calling. Where are you, Bill?
Biddemore.
Oh, okay.
Literally, as we sit here and gaze out on the Fawn City, I'm intrigued by the professor's comment. A fascinating period I know very little about, but it resonated. Your comment about the Clay, as I interpreted it correctly, if I did, felt that it would be impossible to integrate the freed blacks in the South, and therefore advocated other policies. And I'm sort of reminded of people that I met overseas in developing countries, in some cases that were becoming independent, that they said, quote, people here aren't ready for it, which in a way played out in many places with warfare and genocide and political corruption and all kinds of difficulties over the last 50 years. And in some ways, Clay was right in the sense that it's not that the Negro wasn't prepared to become a citizen, it's that the society itself, there were certain structural things going on that it took 150 years, and we're still working at it very, very hard. And so I guess my question is, although the situations are not comparable, were there people at Clay's time that recognized that it might take a very, very, very long time? Or were they just morally kind of liberally blind, as we might say? And I would consider myself liberally blind also in most cases, because I know there was great pressure put on Australia and other countries to essentially grant independence to societies that in retrospect may not have been fully tooled up to do that in terms of industry or sources of income or whatever, how you want to look at it. I mean, not that the people were incapable, it's just that, you know, there were other... Well, it was very hard to enforce the law, and politicians ran around it and feathered their own nest. So the real promise of independence was kind of soured, and some of them had become failed states. Anyway, I was wondering about your comments on that.
Okay.
Well, I think Clay, you understand him very, very clearly, and that he did not believe that the freed slaves were incapable of governing themselves. In fact, he believed very much that they were capable. But he believed that the bigotry of the white population would not allow them to live as equal citizens. In fact, he said that on a number of occasions, that was his largest concern, that the bigotry and discrimination would prevent these people from realizing their full potential. And that's why he did advocate colonization and self-government once the former slaves were colonized, though he did insist that this be completely voluntary. In other words, it would not be a forced colonization. Some static there.
Oh.
That the people who went would go of their own free will. And that was one of the reasons why it couldn't succeed, because most of the freed slaves or former slaves had no desire to leave the United States. It was their home.
Thank you so much, Bill, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation about Henry Clay, the Essential American, 800-486-8655. Let's talk a bit about the many times that he was a presidential aspirant and why he never achieved it.
Well, he ran five times. He was officially in the race three. The first attempt is the 1824 one, which was a very nasty little indecisive election that turned out quite badly for him. The myth of the perpetual presidential aspirant is somewhat overdrawn. The five contests, two of those he never gets the nomination. And in 1840, when he was really deprived of it by some skullduggery at the Whig convention, he was a good soldier, and he campaigned for the candidate, William Henry Harrison, more actively than I think he ever had prior to that, or anyone, or would again. He likely won the 1844 election. There was an inordinate amount of voter fraud in New York State, especially, that gave that state to the Democrat candidate James Polk. And frankly, if the count had been fair and all things else being equal, Clay probably would have been president. And if that had happened, everything would have been different from then on for the country. Almost everything would be different had he been president from 1845 to 1849.
No civil war?
It certainly probably would not have happened as it did. we certainly wouldn't have acquired the Western territories through warfare. That would have been highly unlikely. Clay, if we were going to expand, we would have done it differently. And it is indeed the Western territories and the arguments that they spur over whether they will be free or slave that creates the sectional crisis of the 1850s. It finally does end in the outbreak of secession and the war.
Mm-hmm. I'm always in the mood to hear some good skullduggery, so we'll go back to 1840 in a moment. Connie first, though, from Marshland Township. Hi, Connie.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was wondering about the people that moved to Wisconsin as abolitionists who wanted the state to be non-slave and whether he promoted that. You know, coming to the different territories when the areas were going to be become a state, because my great-great-grandfather came and fought in the Civil War later, but they originally came in 1848, and I wondered, from Ohio, and I wonder if they were abolitionists or not.
They may very well have been.
Mm-hmm. So I just wondered
not sure
if there were other states that. You know, I heard that, mm-hmm. that you know, when it was going to become a state, whether it would be a non-slave or not.
Well, Wisconsin was covered under the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which drew the line at latitude 3630 that said that above that line, none of the new states would be slave states. So during its formative period, there was really never any serious question about Wisconsin becoming a slave state.
Oh, okay.
But Clay would have certainly supported that. He supported the Missouri Compromise, and he, throughout most of his political career, opposed the expansion of slavery, particularly in the latter part of his career. He saw the expansion of slavery as bringing on many of the very mean-spirited debates of the time period, and he believed that if slavery could be contained, that it would reduce the chances that this would bring on an armed conflict.
Mm-hmm. I see.
He also was extremely worried about the expansion of slavery, more firmly fixing it in the American fabric. By the late 1840s, he was on record, and this hurt him with the South, too. He was on record as saying that he would not ever promote or support the placement of slavery where it had not previously existed. And that was especially in regard to California, that he would not support that. He would actively oppose it, in fact. And that is an opinion very similar to that of many Northerners. Who like Lincoln, felt that the expansion of slavery was its most despicable and contemptible facet in a nation that was supposedly committed to human liberty as for everyone. Ultimately, that to say that while you were planting the seeds of slavery where it didn't exist, it was a contemptible hypocrisy.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, sure. Connie.
Thank
Thanks
you.
So much for the call.
And you know, Wisconsin, in fact, is the birthplace of the Republican Party, which
right.
is the descendant, political and ideological descendant of the Whig Party that Clay founded. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, there is that that citizenry there was very committed to the kind of Whig principles that were to be the guiding light during the Civil War.
Here's an email that's come in, and I know you write about this in the book. Was there truly a deal between Clay and John Quincy Adams following the 1824 disputed presidential election that awarded Clay the Secretary of State position?
There's no evidence that they had a concrete deal. Certainly, Clay supported Adams because Adams was by far of the choices that he had. The person who was most in line politically with what Clay believed was best for the country. So, yes, he did support him. That Adams then appointed Clay Secretary of State is not necessarily an indication of a deal. It was a logical step. Clay was an experienced diplomat, was a very senior politician of the time period, and it was a logical thing for Adams to do. Certainly nothing corrupt about it, as the Jackson people claimed, because there was nothing that violated Clay's principles in that arrangement, if there was indeed any kind of arrangement made.
But the people believed Jackson?
Some people did. Jackson had a tremendously modern political operation.
Oh.
And by modern, I mean closer in many ways to today than it was for that time. And they spread the story, and it was sort of, you know, the old saying, you tell a lie often enough. And some people did believe it. Not everyone, and both Adams and Clay will survive politically, though it certainly damaged their reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a number of Jacksonians ultimately came to disbelieve it and admitted as much. Men like Thomas Hart Benton, who said there wasn't anything wrong with this. Ultimately, if Clay was dying when he said that, but it was obviously a contrivance for political opportunism.
Right. Let's talk about all that happened. You write when he headed home after 4.5 decades, passed through a land unrecognizable, altered and marked by unparalleled expansion, that when he had come to Washington, all you could hear was the wind in the trees, the songs of the birds, and the rush of the untamed water. How responsible was he? How much did he push? And what legislation did he help navigate that made a real difference in getting a more booming America, improvements taking place, railroads, et cetera?
Well, whenever you start developing undeveloped areas, you have a chicken-egg problem. It's not profitable to do this, to start it. And the profits are often slow in coming. So private initiative to do this, there's not a lot of incentive for it. Clay realized that, and realized that if we could get the corporate responsibility, either a government that could, in fact, promote the setting for brisk capitalistic enterprises, that they would take root, and the natural abundance of the country, the land, the fecundity, the initiative of the private citizen, would move into these areas and make them flourish. And for that reason, he actually is the first person to run on what we now call a political party platform, which was a system, the American system, that was Clay's American system. It was a sound currency, responsible credit, sponsored for a national setting, the protection of American domestic manufacturers from unfair foreign competition, and the active improvement of the infrastructure, the building of roads, the digging of canals, the dredging of harbors, to facilitate commerce and to make investment from private sources a viable enterprise. And when he left to go to Washington in 1806, just 3 years after the Louisiana Purchase, most of the country was just a wilderness, at best crisscrossed by random paths. When he went home after his death by way of railroads and steamboats,
goodness,
And such, the country had been transformed and was on the verge of the dawn of the industrial age. Clay's influence in that is immeasurable.
Mm. Isn't that remarkable? It happened in such a short period of time.
Yes. You know, Jefferson, when they bought Louisiana, said it would take 100 generations to settle the land.
Huh.
And Clay, in that regard, knew the calendar was going to be much more accelerated.
Kurt in Chippewa Falls is next. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. Thank you. Really terrific history here. You are providing, you know, what I consider a healthy perspective on which a serious study and writing on history ought to do. What I find remarkable is that we look back at these historical figures, Clay, Jackson, what have you, and they start confusing our current partisan positions as to who is conservative, who is liberal, who is right, who is wrong. And what I see happening here, where even Teddy Roosevelt, I've said, is being characterized as a socialist or a Marxist or a fascist and so forth, this tendency of passionate partisans to cast everything in some sort of eternal, perpetual good versus evil, right versus wrong. But your presentation gets us all mixed up. Clay or Jackson hold positions and have opinions on things that are across the board. They don't fit the mold. What would your advice to our current passionate partisanship be?
Well, one of the things that people could do is that they could take a leaf out of Mr. Clay's book, known as the Great Compromiser. He did strike a lot of deals in Congress, but two questions always came into his mind when he was brokering any of these deals, either producing the compromises or making the arrangements with fellow legislators as to whether or not they should be passed. And those were, can the issue be solved, good for the country, without violating the will of the people? And two, can...
I'm afraid we've lost Gene.
I'm going out for some reason.
We just missed a little bit.
Okay. The second point that he would always consider is, can the arrangement be made honorably? And I think if with every question, whether it's a national, local, state issue, if those two questions can be answered in the positive, then politics, I think, would be a much more civil endeavor.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Kurt, for your interesting comments and questions. At some point, you say, and I just want for you to amplify on this, losing Henry Clay was a uniquely personal event for the nation because his life had been the mirror of his country and its aspirations. That's a big statement.
Yeah, Clay, born at the during the Revolution, and his life spanning the formative period of the early Republic into the antebellum period, that is America. His story is the American story. He rises from humble beginnings, not impoverished ones, but humble ones, to become a self-made man who, through hard work and industry, perspicacity and aptitude, rises to the top levels of his endeavors, whether it be agriculture, breeding horse flesh, or going to Washington and making policy. And when he dies, the country realizes that they will never see anything like him again. That there is that he was indeed a giant passing in the twilight.
Let's welcome more phone calls. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. And we're speaking with David and Gene Heidler, who are the authors of Henry Clay, The Essential American. The Heidlers have written many books dealing with the history of the early American Republic, the antebellum period, and the Civil War. David is with the Department of History at Colorado State University in Pueblo, and Gene is a professor of history at the United States Air Force Academy. Lines are open for you should you care to join this conversation or email the show. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls in a moment. I know that Lincoln read Clay's speeches again and again. Are there certain speeches that you think that we should read and pay attention to, David and Gene?
You know, those speeches that occur during the great debate over the Compromise of 1850 are some of the finest things he says.
Hmm.
They are remarkable statements that in many respects foreshadow Lincoln's statements on the eve of and during the Civil War. There's an extemporaneous remark that Clay makes in the Senate in which he anticipates the first inaugural of Lincoln, the first inaugural address, in saying that the South and the North cannot be but friends, that they must be friends, and that anything that would make them enemies and put them at each other's throats must be avoided at all costs. And that anticipates Lincoln's peroration in the first inaugural address, in which we are not enemies but friends, we must be friends, and talks of the better angels of our nature. That sort of behavior, or sort of expression, is eerily foreshadowing of the kinds of things Lincoln would say.
Right. Let's go to John now from Madison. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is, did Clay ever come to realize that the rampant anti-intellectualism that accompanied slavery in the South had won and had triumphed and had assured that the only solution to slavery was a civil war?
I don't think he was willing to accept that civil war was inevitable. I think he was, by the time he died in 1852, he was discouraged. He had hoped that the compromise in 1850 would calm things, and it was becoming obvious by that summer when he did die that simply was not the case, that things were already coming apart. But he was an eternally optimistic, and I don't think he ever gave up hope completely that a solution could be reached.
You write about his eulogies that were delivered in the House of Representatives, and it also points to, David, the divisions in the country, who the people were who spoke and what part of the country they were from.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting numbers and statistical analysis of what sections the numbers represent. The Deep South was amazingly silent about Clay, with only a couple of exceptions. Most of the encomiums came from the other sections, the West obviously, and then the North. And the Democrats, although there were Democrats who said very kind things about Clay, they were in the minority. It was obvious that by this point, even a great compromiser, even a great pacificator, was not going to be able to calm the roiling waters. And true enough, 2 years after Clay's passing, the Kansas-Nebraska Act really kicks off a firestorm that never dies down and ultimately ends with the tragedy that unfolds in the 1860s.
He had a charming, I'd like to talk about just the way he presented himself in the world. I love the picture on the book, and people talked about his eyes, which you're drawn to immediately, but he had a rather charming way about him by all accounts, didn't he?
He was a very good-natured person, and as we talked about before, had a great sense of humor. So he approached virtually everyone he met as a friend, and eventually, of course, some people ceased to be friends. But he really did, again, that optimistic nature that he had, did look on human nature in a very positive way, and I think that drew people to him. Those people who became his friends were incredibly loyal to him. And as one of his political enemies said, he never deserted a friend, even for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they said, you're mistaken. He told these people who were talking about Clay as, horned and cloven-footed, he said, you're mistaking political alliances with friendship. Henry Clay doesn't have alliances. He has friends. And that alone makes him a power to be reckoned with.
It sure does. What an important thing that is. And we don't see a whole lot of it in politics these days, do we?
Oh, yeah. Mostly alliances, huh?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So what do you two talk about at the dinner table? I was just wondering.
Usually sports or... yes, a lot of times people ask us, you must talk about history all the time, and we generally let go of history when it comes time for dinner talk.
You talk sports. And is there another figure like Clay, and I'm so glad you wrote the book on Clay, is there somebody else you think has been neglected and you're going to bring that person alive again?
Well, we're not quite willing to give up on Mr. Clay. We will probably return to him at some
really?
Point.
Really? Great.
Yes. Not right away. We're going to let it rest just a little bit.
I can see why. This was a very, very thorough, exhaustive work. I thank you both so much for being with us. I just really enjoyed the hour, and it's a wonderful book. Very well done. Very and great to read as well. It's a great story.
Well, thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you very much.
This was very nice, and it just flew by, didn't it?
It did fly by. I know. Yeah, it flew by. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The book is Henry Clay, The Essential American. David and Jean Heidler, you spell their last name Heidler, and it has just been published by Random House. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production, for your calls and emails. We thank you as well. I'll be with you again on Monday. One of our guests for All Things Political, E.J. Dionne, will be with us. And Nancy Pearl. We haven't talked to Nancy in a long time. Nancy's going to be talking about traveling, travel books, and books that you should take with you when you travel. Those are always great shows, recommendations, fast and furious, and they're fun. So until then, great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.